walked in a manner of modesty. That's so beautiful.
It is.
Or there are the verses about the hijab, which is not the topic for today. But I'm just trying to say that the Quran attracts our attention to the topic of haya and not hijab. So if it's nowadays and we're going with a guy, we're taking him somewhere to our home, we start chit-chatting on the way, like, how's work with you? What do you do? What do you study? Oh, it's so nice to see you, right? But this is the manner that the daughter of Shu'aib...
No, we're a complete stranger.
Yeah, but we say you have to be sociable. And it's actually equality in the Western and the secular value system. Just sitting there and looking at each other, they say, oh, she's antisocial. Mm.
But times, I think, with the dawn of, I think, the internet, which has given a platform to a lot of introverts and socially awkward individuals to have a platform and to have a voice and to express themselves, it has come with a great extent of training, and I don't enjoy it. You know?
To talk to people.
Yeah. Social people enjoy socializing. Yeah. I do it out of, you know, basic courtesy.
Yeah.
Thank you to Sister Razia for this interesting discourse. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illa Allah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the special point regarding Sheikh Abdulmunim al-Zayn is that broadened his activities and focused on invitation for local people.
So over there we see that he start to create relationship with the Sunni leaders and make them to get convinced to accept the school of Ahlul Bayt as one of the formal or official denominations of Islam.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
So the program The Teacher is about the life and the works and the methods of research of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, philosophers, jurists, and thinkers all across the nation of Islam, especially the Shiite ones. And for today's discussion, we want to discuss the life and works of a person who has spent most of his life in the country Senegal, one of the African countries, being busy with spreading Islam over there. He is no one but Abdulmunim Zayn, the outstanding Lebanese cleric. Okay, Sheikh Ziyaniya, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the education and early life of Abdulmunim Zayn.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Abdulmunim Zayn is a Lebanese cleric that was a student of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr. And by suggestion of Imam Musa al-Sadr, he moved from Lebanon to Africa, and especially to the country of Senegal, in the city of Dakar, the capital of the country.
Okay.
You know, at that time, and currently, of course, there were some Lebanese living in Africa. You know, Lebanese are living all around the world.
Yes.
Lebanon is a special country in this case.
Yes.
And the population of Lebanese that are living all around the world are more the population Lebanese that are living in Lebanon itself.
Okay.
So many of them are living in Africa, and some of them are living in the west of Africa. That Senegal also is in the west of Africa.
That's right.
So Sheikh Abdulmunim al-Zayn moved from Lebanon to Senegal to stay there and to be a resident scholar and resident sheikh for people and the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wassalam over there.
Was it by the invitation of Sayyid al-Sadr, Imam Musa al-Sadr, in order to go there, in order to preach Islam or something like
yes.
that?
Yes. Okay. You know, Imam Musa al-Sadr paid a visit to Africa after that he was chosen. Of course, he was the founder of the
yes.
Majlis A'la in Lebanon. So after founding that, you know, Congress, he had some visits to some other countries. He paid a visit to Africa, some of the countries that one of them was Senegal.
Yes.
And after returning back to Lebanon, they asked him when he was there, they asked him to send a sheikh for them.
Okay.
That's why he asks Sheikh Abdulmunim al-Zayn to go to Senegal to be a resident scholar over there.
Okay.
So, but the special point regarding Sheikh Abdulmunim al-Zayn is that he didn't, you know, limit and specialized his activities only for Lebanese. Of course, he was invited by them. He settled in Dakar to preach for Lebanese, first of all.
Yes.
But he broadened his activities and focused on invitation for local people.
That's right.
So that's why, after some years, because he moved to Senegal in 1969.
Yes.
And now it's about 40 years that he is over there. He was a young man.
Maybe 50 years.
Yes,
from
more than 40 years.
Up to 20. Yeah, 50 years, that's right.
It's about 50 years.
Okay.
So after these years, we may find that he has invited more than 100,000 people to the School of Thought of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wa salam, and established many schools over there.
Okay.
And, you know, to have a way to introduce the School of Thought of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wa salam to people, clearly a true follower of this hadith of Imam al-Sadr alayhi salam, that His Holiness says, كونوا لنا زينا ولا تكونوا لنا شينا. Be glory for us, but not be shame for us.
Okay.
So he tried to broadcast the voice of Ahlul Bayt amongst local people, mm-hmm. and to be a good role model in this That's regard right. for other sheikhs also.
Especially we know that Africa in that time, 50, 60 years ago, the country Senegal, for sure must not have facilities for life, for example, as it was in even in Lebanon at that time, you know, it was... And the population over there might not be familiar with some presuppositions or Islamic background. So it is really, I think, a difficult task for a muballigh to go to a strange land with a strange people, a strange culture, and they step by step invite them into, can say, the Shiite Islam. Up to an extent that they were calling him as the Shiite Caliph over there, or the Shiite chief over there. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, I think the main mission of such muballigh and scholars is this, in order to spread Islam and familiarize the people of the foreign lands and the far lands with the Shiite Islam. How much do you think Abdul Munim Zain was successful in Senegal?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think Sheikh Abdul Munim Zain, as our brother mentioned, was a true follower of Ahlul Bayt, and we can call him the alim, or the scholar of the time and space. Mm-hmm. Because when he moved to Senegal, he knew that Islam had a very long route in Senegal, because in the west of the Africa, we have many Muslim communities. Mm-hmm. So this is not to say it's kind of Central Africa or south of the Africa, which Christianity is a dominating religion over there.
Okay.
But in the west of the Africa, we have Islamic communities growing over there. So he was really understanding the time and the issues of time and space. So we can say, as our brother mentioned, since he went there under the suggestion and recommendation of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr, he followed the same steps that Sayyid Musa al-Sadr or Imam Musa al-Sadr did in Lebanon, okay. in order to bring glory and actually dignity for Shia community in Lebanon, That's for right. the Lebanese community. So over there, we see that he start to create relationship with the Sunni leaders mm-hmm. in terms or under the umbrella of Islam, to put aside all differences and sit around one table, start communicating with them, That's and right. make them to get convinced to accept Shiism or the school of Ahlul Bayt as one of the formal or official denominations of Islam.
That's right.
Because living in Iran or Shia community will make us to judge that Shia or school of Ahlul Bayt must be accepted by all people all around the world.
Yes.
But because of the propaganda against Shia school of thought, some of the Muslims are not going to treat Shias as Muslims
okay.
because of the propaganda.
Yes.
So he was knowing this issue. Mm-hmm. When he moved to Senegal, first of all, he sat with the leaders of Sunnis, starting to make this Shia school of thought as one of the official denominations.
That's right.
So it is also mentioned in his biography as one of his achievements mm-hmm. that by his effort, they actually recognized Shia as one of the denominations, the same as those four denominations of Islam that we have.
Right.
This was one of the steps that he did, and Imam Musa al-Sadr also did in Lebanon. After this, he was actually looking at the youth uh-huh. and kids
okay.
because he was aware that if anything is going to happen, it will happen based on this potential, which is within the youth and kids. So we see in his biography that more than 120 schools he established.
Oh.
So this is something great. Mm-hmm. So to go there,
yes.
start benefiting from the support of your Lebanese brothers okay. among you, because as yes. our brother mentioned, Lebanese are good businessmen,
yes.
specifically in Africa. So benefiting from this money
okay.
and capital in order to spread Shia, but technically and systematically.
Yes. Yes.
And besides school, he established many masajid.
Mm-hmm.
And besides masajid, many Islamic entities,
yes,
or let's say charity entities.
Yes.
As we look at these parts, we see that these are different pillars with which he was actually capable of bringing about Shia community.
That's right.
But why? Because creating a community is not only based on going up the member and start giving and delivering speeches.
That's right.
You have to work on the youth. You have to work on the kids. You have to start communication with the leaders, I mean other leaders,
yes,
to receive some sort of acceptance,
yes,
in the community.
Okay.
And as we see, he was granted this chance to receive the national medal from the president of Senegal. It shows that how powerfully he was taking his steps in order to create this community.
I think he was directly under the influence of the method of the preaching and tabligh of Imam Musa Sadr. This interface, intraface dialogue that Imam Musa Sadr was after, and not focusing on the differences between the religions, rather on the commonalities, can obviously be seen in the works of Sheikh Abdul Munim Zain too. That was, he was successful. And politically speaking, most of the African countries, you know, we know that the African lands, because of the situation over there, because they have been monopolized by the arrogant superpowers for so many years, they are, I think, after justice. And they are after, we can say, seeking justice. So when a person under the slogan and banner of Islam, which is the slogan of brotherhood, Ukhuwwah and Mawaddah, comes to their land, they are welcomed very much. And Sheikh Abdul Munim, I think, was successful. And as you said, politically speaking, he could reach the medal, you know, the national medal trophy of the country in 2014 by the president over there. He has also authored some books, you know, he was, yes, active authoring some books, presenting in the conferences over there, and publishing his works in both English language and the Arabic language, which was his mother tongue. Okay, any other details about his life, Sheikh Zainia?
Maybe this point is also interesting regarding the manner that he was using, mm-hmm, to invite people, mm-hmm, to the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salatu wassalam. That is, he says that the first step that I took was giving some books to people as a gift. When they started studying these books, after some while, I was talking to them, okay, how did you find this book? And we had some discussions for some hours about the subjects that were discussed in, yes, the book. And then after some, you know, discussions, if the person was, you know, agreed, he would recite, he or she would recite Shahadatain.
Yes.
And I would like to mention this, that this is exactly in accordance with the verse of Holy Quran, that Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim in Surah An-Nahl. أدعو إلى سبيل ربك بالحكمة والموعظة الحسنة. And Sheikh Abdul Munim Azzain is correctly and truly using this manner and method.
Ahsan.
That he is using books, حكمة والموعظة الحسنة. He talks to people,
giving them advices.
Yes.
Beautiful.
And then lets them think. Okay, if you agree and if you want, you may recite Shahadatain. And then he used to give them certificates regarding this.
Yes.
To, you know, we may say authenticate,
yes,
the personality of, you know, Shia people over there. Another, that's important, right, point is that he had good relationship with Sunni brothers,
mm-hmm,
in a way that after living some years in Senegal, because now he is he has the nationality of Senegal,
mm-hmm,
and
oh, really?
From 1987, yeah, he, yes, was given this nationality,
Lebanese Senegalese
double nationality.
Yes,
so he, you know, interacted with Sunni brothers, mm-hmm, in a way that the imams of the school of thought of Ahlus Sunnah, they were so, there, mm-hmm, are, yes, four imams,
yes,
Maliki, Hanbali, Shafi'i, and Hanafi,
yes,
and they called the most prominent scholar in their, you know, school of thought, they call it Khalifa,
yes,
Caliph.
Yes.
Sheikh Abdul Munim Azzain interacted with them in a way that they accepted him, mm-hmm, as the fifth caliph.
Caliph.
And, okay, that's why he is called the caliph of Ithna Ashari school of thought.
Okay. Caliph means the chief or the,
yes,
head of
the chief
an Islamic sect or denomination. this title was given to him. And this, you know, formal recognition or the official recognition of the school of thought of the Ahlul Bayt among our Sunni brethren really show that our Sunni brethren are also welcoming the ideas of the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. They have respect for the Shiite Imams. But unfortunately, in today's world, the segregationists and seditionists all around the world try to plant the seed of disagreement and discord among the Muslims. But the works of people like Abdul Munim Zain shows that it is possible that we have peaceful talks with our Sunni brethren in far, far lands, and then the people are free in order to choose their beliefs, whether it be according to the Sunni beliefs or the Shiite beliefs. And Abdul Munim Zain, I think, was the source of benefit for so many people over there. Okay? Any other detail? No? Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziaunia and Sheikh Mahtavi, for your presence in the program, the teacher. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala protect the people and preachers and muballiqin like Abdul Munim Zain, you know, the people who spend their life in far, far lands away from, believe me, it is very much difficult to leave your homeland, to leave the people with your same language and the culture, you know, and go to a far, far land, living over there, preach Islam. And inshallah, the sawab and the reward of these people is multiplied by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, anywhere they are. Thank you much. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, which was about the Lebanese scholar Abdul Munim Zain, who is spending most of his life in preaching Shia Islam in Senegal in West Africa. For more information, you can visit our website at parstoday.com/Shia and Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
In the limelight. The chairman of the Congressional Committee investigating the U.S. Capitol attack and Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election revealed on Sunday, 23rd of January, that the panel has spoken to the former Attorney General William Barr, a further indication that the inquiry has moved closer to the ex-president's inner circle. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, Capital Attack Committee Has Spoken to Trump Attorney General William Barr, Chairman Says. Chairman of the Congressional Committee investigating the U.S. Capitol attack and Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election revealed on Sunday, 23rd of January, that the panel has spoken to the former Attorney General William Barr, a further indication that the inquiry has moved closer to the former president's inner circle. Benny Thompson, the chairman of the Congressional Committee investigating the U.S. Capitol attack, told CBS's Face the Nation program that William Barr, who was accused of making the Justice Department Donald Trump's tool, but who resigned before Donald Trump left office, had spoken more than once with the panel. To be honest with you, we've had conversations with the former Attorney General, William Barr, already, Benny Thompson said. His host, Margaret Brennan, asked if the panel would seek answers from William Barr over the discovery of a draft executive order for the U.S. military to seize voting machines in contested states. We have talked to Department of Defense individuals, Benny Thompson said. We are concerned that our military was part of this big lie on promoting that the election was false. If you're using the military to potentially seize voting machines, even though it's a discussion, the public needs to know. News of the interviews with William Barr, who angered Donald Trump by insisting there was no evidence to support his lies of a stolen election, dealt another blow to the former president, whose political and legal woes escalated significantly this week. Unlike other Trump world insiders who have refused to cooperate with the January 6th House committee, such as the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, Trump strategist Steve Bannon, and National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, William Barr appears to have spoken to the panel willingly. It reflects moves by the House panel to focus more closely on Donald Trump's actions following the election, including his inciting of the deadly 6th of January attack on the U.S. Capitol. This week, the House committee asked for the cooperation of Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka. Our strategy is to get to all the facts and circumstances that brought about 6th of January, Benny Thompson said. And obviously, Ivanka Trump was a major advisor to the president all along. A number of items are attributed to what she's been saying, and so we asked her to come in voluntarily and give us the benefit of what she knows. The inquiry has also subpoenaed phone records of Donald Trump's son, Eric, as well as Kimberly Guilfoyle, partner of Donald Trump Jr. Donald Trump is not pleased, complaining in an interview with right-wing Washington Examiner that the committee was made up of vicious people who go after children. Donald Trump Jr. is 44 years old, Ivanka Trump is 40 years old, and Eric Trump is 38. The House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack is asking Ivanka Trump, the daughter of the former president, to appear for a voluntary deposition to answer questions about Donald Trump's efforts to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election victory. The move by the panel marks an aggressive new phase in its inquiry into the 6th of January insurrection, as House investigators seek for the first time testimony from a member of the Trump family about potential criminality on the part of the former President Donald Trump. Congressman Benny Thompson, the chair of the Select Committee, said in an 11-page letter to Ivanka Trump that the panel wanted to ask about Donald Trump's plan to stop the certification and his response to the Capitol attack, including delays to deploying the National Guard. Ivanka Trump was a senior advisor to her father during his presidency, as was her husband, Jared Kushner. The two were seen as a power couple, very close to the inner workings of the Trump White House. The questions to Ivanka appeared directly at a key issue, whether her father oversaw a criminal conspiracy on 6th of January that also involved obstructing a congressional proceeding, a crime. The letter said that the panel first wanted to question Ivanka Trump about what she recalled of a heated Oval Office meeting on the morning of 6th of January insurrection, when the former president was trying to co-opt Mike Pence into rejecting Joe Biden's win. The former president was on the phone with the then vice president in an Oval Office meeting with Ivanka Trump and Keith Kellogg, a top Mike Pence aide, the letter said. When Mike Pence demurred on the former president's repeated request, Ivanka turned to Keith Kellogg and said, "Mike Pence is a good man."
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, training children. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of training the children in the Islamic lifestyle. As we know that children are the main part of a family, and in Islam, there is a lot of emphasis on having children and making the new generation, bringing the new generation. Therefore, Islam has paid a lot of attention towards their training as well. It is not to just bring kids to have children. Rather, the important part is training them. And that is very important, because in the Quran, we can see there are many verses, and also in the narrations, there is a lot of emphasis which talks about the training the children, how a father should spend time with the children, how mother should spend time with the children. And on top of that, because this training is being given to the mother, and obviously the duty of training kids is being given to the mother and also father, so there is an importance of this topic. Therefore, we can see that in the narrations, it is said that the A'imma alayhim as-salam used to give importance to this topic, where they used to emphasize the fathers, or used to command the fathers to spend some time with their kids so that they are trained well, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of training children in the Islamic lifestyle. Now, when we say that Islam has paid a lot of emphasis on the training of children, it is because this is the children who will carry on what you have taught to them, or the next generation is the children. Therefore, in order to have a pure society, in order to have good people in the society, it is very necessary to train the kids, or train the children in a way so that tomorrow when they go to the society, and tomorrow when they are serving the society, they can serve the society in the best way, or in its best means. Therefore, this is important in Islam, that when we train the children, we train them in a way so that we can have a good society. And in today's world, when we look at all these difficulties, all these frauds or oppression or injustice, one of the reasons, and this is the first and foremost reason for having such a situation, is that in the houses, in the homes, we do not have a good training for our children. We do not train them according to the teachings of Islam. We do not train them to become good human beings. And therefore, when they are grown up, they become someone who is disturbing the society, who does not match the pure society. Therefore, we need to be careful, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Dozens of women journalists and human rights defenders in Bahrain and Jordan have had their phones hacked using NSO Group's Pegasus spyware, according to a report by Frontline Defenders and Access Now. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Anna Maria Silik, writer. This article is titled Pegasus Spyware Used Against Dozens of Activist Women in West Asia. Stay tuned for more. Dozens of women journalists and human rights defenders in Bahrain and Jordan have had their phones hacked using NSO Group's Pegasus spyware, according to a report by Frontline Defenders and Access Now. The report adds to a growing public record of Pegasus misuse globally, including against dissidents, reporters, diplomats, and members of the clergy. It also threatens to increase pressure on the Zionist regime-based NSO Group, which in November was placed on a U.S. trade blacklist. When governments surveil women, they are working to destroy them, wrote Marwa Fatfa, the West Asia region and North Africa policy manager at Access Now, in a statement accompanying the report. Surveillance is an act of violence. It is about exerting power on every aspect of a woman's life through intimidation, harassment, and character assassination. The NSO Group and its clients are all responsible and must be publicly exposed and disgraced. NSO Group was placed on the trade blacklist after a consortium of journalists working with the French non-profit Forbidden Stories reported multiple cases in which journalists and activists appear to have been targeted by foreign governments using the spyware. The same month, researchers from Amnesty International and the University of Toronto Citizen Lab said they found Pegasus on the phones of 6 Palestinian human rights activists. Last week, another Citizen Lab report found that dozens of Salvadoran human rights activists' phones had been hacked using Pegasus. Pegasus is breathtaking in its ability to take complete control of a device without detection and is often referred to as military-grade spyware. Researchers have said that it can access every message the subject has sent and received, including from encrypted messaging services. It can also access the camera and microphone, record the screen and monitor the subject's location via GPS. Apple sued NSO Group in November, trying to stop the company's software from compromising its operating systems. That followed a similar suit from Facebook in 2019, alleging that the company was hacking the social media giant's WhatsApp messaging service. NSO Group did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the new report, but earlier this week, in the wake of the El Salvador research, it said that it only grants licenses to government intelligence and law enforcement agencies following a process of investigation and licensing by the Zionist regime's Ministry of War. The company added that the use of its cybersecurity tools to monitor dissidents, activists, and journalists is a serious misuse of that technology. In a study published in December 2020, Citizen Lab identified 20 countries whose governments had acquired surveillance systems from Circles, a company affiliated with NSO Group. Australia, Belgium, Botswana, Chile, Denmark, Ecuador, El Salvador, Estonia, Equatorial Guinea, Guatemala, Honduras, Indonesia, the Zionist regime, Kenya, Malaysia, Mexico, Morocco, Nigeria, Peru, Serbia, Thailand, the United Arab Emirates, Vietnam, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The hacks of the activists in Jordan and Bahrain now add to two more countries to the list. The report documents how Pegasus can have a particularly egregious impact on women who are disproportionately vulnerable to the weaponization of personal information when governments seek to intimidate, harass, and publicly smear dissidents. In details, the case of Ebtisam As-Sayeq, a renowned human rights defender who works in Bahrain with the advocacy group Salam for Democracy and Human Rights. As-Sayeq's iPhone was hacked at least 8 times between August and November 2019 with Pegasus spyware, according to the researchers. The privacy violations extended what the report described as brutal harassment by Bahraini authorities. On May 26, 2017, the report said Bahrain's National Security Agency summoned As-Sayeq to Al Muharraq police station. Interrogators subjected her to verbal abuse and physically beat and sexually assaulted her. They threatened her with rape if she did not hold her human rights activism. Upon release, she was immediately taken to a hospital. The report quotes As-Sayeq as saying, "I am in a state of daily fear and terror after I was informed by frontline defenders that I was spied on. I started to be afraid of having the phone next to me, especially when I am at home among my family, my children, and my husband." Frontline Defenders forensic investigation found that As-Sayeq's phone was compromised multiple times in August 2019. On September 19, 2019, and on November 22, 2019, traces of process names linked to Pegasus were identified on her home. Amnesty International Security Lab and the Citizen Lab have both attributed these process names to NSO spyware. Another victim described in the report is Hala Ahedib, a human rights activist and member of the legal team defending the Jordan Teachers Syndicate, one of the country's largest labor unions. The Jordanian government dissolved the union in December 2020 in response to mass protests. Deeb's phone was compromised by Pegasus on March 16, 2021, according to the report. Other victims mentioned in the report include Emirati activist Alaa As-Siddiq, Al-Arabi journalist Rania Derdi, and Al Jazeera broadcast journalist Qada Oseis. The report calls for an immediate moratorium on the use, sale, and transfer of surveillance technologies produced by private firms until adequate human rights safeguards and regulation is in place, and a move to take serious and effective measures against surveillance technology providers like NSO Group.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Germany's stance in the escalating tensions between Russia and Ukraine is under increased scrutiny. Although other NATO allies, including the US, have also agreed to export weapons directly to Ukraine, the German government has so far declined to do so. The Wall Street Journal reported on Saturday that Berlin has refused to issue permits for weapons exports from Estonia to Ukraine.
The Germans do have a history of de-escalating and of not trying in any case to be in the forefront if there is any conflict. In the case of Ukraine, the official wording is that the Germans bear a responsibility for the happenings, the adventures of the last war.
German government officials have said they oppose sending arms to Ukraine as they fear that such deliveries could push tensions higher and make negotiations more difficult. That's while Germany remains one of the world's top arms producers and exporters, with sales increasing 21% from 2016 to 2020. Kiev is furious over Germany's decision and is accusing Berlin of encouraging Russia to invade Ukraine, while the Kremlin denies the allegations. The US, Britain, and several Baltic states have agreed to send Kiev weapons, including anti-tank and anti-aircraft missiles. Meanwhile, some 90 tons of US lethal aid arrived in Ukraine on Saturday. The consignment is the first shipment of a $200 million package the US approved in December. Conversely, the shipment arrived hours after Russia's foreign minister and his U.S. counterpart held what they called frank talks to try to reduce the chance of a wider conflict in Ukraine. Also, it is believed that Washington is using the Ukraine crisis as a pretext to further its policy of attempting to restrain Russia and China. Washington has threatened several German companies involved in the construction of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline with economic sanctions. The completed multi-billion dollar pipeline is set to double Russian gas supplies to Germany, but has been entangled in a highly politicized approval process.
That pipeline, since more than 1 month, is ready to deliver. It is ready to deliver all that is missing, or nearly all that is missing, in the European and German market. But we are stopping it. We are blocking it on behalf of Washington. Crazy story.
Therefore, this is every indication that it is NATO members who are escalating tensions around Ukraine. The US, its NATO allies, and Ukraine have accused Moscow of amassing troops near Ukraine's border for a possible invasion. But Moscow says it has deployed troops along its western border to ensure its security in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. The UK has accused Russia of trying to install an ally in Ukraine. This provoked a strong response from Moscow, calling the allegations nothing but nonsense and disinformation. In a statement released on Saturday, the British Foreign Office claimed to have information that indicates the Russian government is looking to install a pro-Russian leader in Kiev and is considering a former Ukrainian lawmaker as a potential candidate. It also claimed that Russia is gearing up to invade and occupy Ukraine.
They are doing regime change globally, and they think this is their God-given right to do that. They want it for Iran, they want it for South American countries like Venezuela, they tried with Guaido. This is typical Western policy, and now they're accusing again, you know, another country of what they are doing themselves. That is also a very typical US and NATO story.
It seems that London is following in Washington's footsteps. It has also threatened Russia with severe economic sanctions if it goes ahead with the alleged scheme. The UK had also supplied 2,000 missiles and a team of elite troops to Ukraine this week amid rising tensions. The timing and mysterious nature of the intelligence disclosure coincides with bombshell revelations about a series of parties at Downing Street during COVID lockdowns, as well as a record inflation level. It is also fueling the widespread discontent with the Boris Johnson government. He is now facing resignation calls even from within his own party. This raises a question, and that is whether some in the British government are simply eager to deflect attention from the problems that threaten to topple Prime Minister Boris Johnson. For the first time, the Pentagon has declassified and publicly released footage of the U.S. drone strike in Kabul that killed 10 civilians, including 7 children. It was one of the U.S. military's final acts in Afghanistan before ending its 20-year-long military intervention in the country. The videos show the scene of the strike before, during, and after a missile struck a civilian car in a courtyard on August 29th in Kabul. Indistinct images show individuals moving in or near the attack zone. The Pentagon initially defended the attack, claiming it had targeted an operative of Daesh terrorist group. But in November, the Pentagon acknowledged it had committed a tragic mistake. Instead of terminating a terrorist, the U.S. military had killed a civilian and 9 members of his family. 3 months later, the department announced no one would be held accountable for the brutal carnage. Critics believe such reports failed to address the systematic problems in U.S. conduct of drone warfare, making future civilian casualties inevitable. Now, many Afghans, including the victims' relatives, want the Kabul strike to be regarded as a war crime. Afghans say the U.S. military had acknowledged such strikes as mistakes in the past, but their perpetrators were never brought to justice. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drones and airstrikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have also accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them.
Now, if you're talking about rules of war, the traditional understanding of the just war, the Geneva Conventions, any of these things, you cannot deliberately target a civilian population. That's a war crime if you do that. But it became the tradition because of World War II. And because the United States won World War II, then they could establish this as a kind of right.
Despite the shambolic withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, the Biden administration has said it will continue to use aerial attacks, including drone raids, to deal with security threats in the country and counter Daesh terrorists. However, the killing of innocent civilians in Kabul raised questions about the future of U.S. drone attacks in Afghanistan. Now, advocates have decried the U.S. administration's stated plan. The Afghan American advocacy group Afghans for a Better Tomorrow has urged an end to all U.S. drone strikes in the country, saying it's a failed policy that harms lives, destroys villages, and only allows for more violence to exist in Afghanistan. That's while the U.S. has a history of conducting similar strikes in Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan out of the spotlight without accepting any responsibility while destroying the lives of civilians. According to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars, the U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000.
The strategy of attacking civilians was established then. It's immoral. It's clearly immoral, but they've been doing it for 70 years now. And where do you draw the line? How do you say, oh, beginning in 1972, it became immoral? No, it's the whole tradition of air warfare is by its the way it's been executed here has been immoral from the beginning.
The high number of civilian casualties in U.S. airstrikes in various theaters calls under question the authenticity of Washington's claims of fighting terrorists and its intelligence precision. In late December, leaked Pentagon documents show that the U.S. air wars in West Asia have been marked by flawed intelligence, faulty targeting, years of civilian deaths, and scant accountability. This has further fueled the criticism of the Biden administration's Afghanistan policy and chaotic withdrawal of American troops from the country after two decades of war.
Iran, Russia, and China began joint military drills in the north of the Indian Ocean on Friday. Dubbed the 2022 Marine Security Belt, the exercises are the third to have been carried out between the three countries. The drills cover 17,000 square kilometers of ocean. Vessels and equipment from both Iran's army and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps were on maneuvers. A variety of tactical exercises, such as rescuing burning vessels, releasing hijacked vessels, shooting at specific targets, shooting at air targets at night, and other tactical and operational exercises were carried out during the drills. Strengthening the security of the international maritime trade, combating piracy and maritime terrorism, exchanging intelligence in the field of maritime rescue missions, and exchanging operational and technical experience were among the objectives of the 2022 Marine Security Belt exercise.
So I believe that the message is mostly to the people and to the nation, like the United States or other allies, that they want to have, they want to carry on some kind of activities in this area. And if you ask me if this one is something where it will create a kind of joint action between Iran, Russia, and China, I would say yes, in this area. I don't think that they will tolerate in the future any kind of activities that we can define as terrorist or attack or pirates or these kind of things.
Iran says its presence in the international coalitions manifests the improvement of the Islamic Republic's standing in the world. An Iranian spokesman for the joint drills says Tehran attaches great importance to the establishment of security at regional and international levels. The trilateral exercises come as Iran is taking steps to balance its foreign policy. While talks on the revival of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, and the removal of U.S. sanctions against Iran are underway in the Austrian capital, Vienna, Tehran is expanding its ties with its two key allies, Russia and China. Earlier this month, Iran and China began the implementation of much-anticipated Sino-